we too north to be south, south to be north, where I'm from, Virginia, of course, south to be north, too north to be south, what it's like, hey yo, it is what it is, yeah, hey yo, it is what it is, hey yo, it is what it is, it could be nothing else, we brought down place off.
Hey Matt, what's up? It's Andy Kyle.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. How is your memory in terms of the old days?
You know, you wouldn't think it would. I can remember things back that far, but I was listening to your podcast with Brian the other day, and it's just so funny all the different stories he was telling. It brought back a lot of those memories. So it's, believe it or not, surprisingly, my memory is pretty good about a lot of that.
Nice. Well, we're going to test that out. So are you originally from Ruston?
Well, not originally. I grew up, my dad worked for the government. So we were kind of all around, but I moved to Ruston, when I was in, let's see, it was seventh grade. So it would have been about 84, 85 ish. So it was right around there.
And were you already playing music by the time you were in seventh grade?
No, actually, believe it or not, I just, you know, I'd always been into music. You know, of course, like most people that got into punk and hardcore and everything at a certain time, my listening tastes weren't all that great. You know, in 83, 84, it was mostly like, you know, Duran Duran, and you know, it kind of skews some U2's War album and everything. So I was a very musical person, but it wasn't until I moved to Ruston that it was basically a friend of mine that I went to high school with, Ben Rosenquist, who was he's one of those guys that was drumming on his desk with his fingers at school, and drumming on textbooks, and you know, kind of like you hear the stories of, you know, Tony Lee talking about how he would always hit pots and pans with wooden spoons and stuff. You know, Ben was always like that. And just one day, he was like, "Hey, we should start a band." And I didn't really play any musical instruments at the time. So, but my dad had a bass. And he was a big musician, not professionally, but in his spare time, he would play like jazz and stuff like that. He actually had like these Roland DX7 keyboards, and he had like these MIDI sequencers and stuff. So he would just kind of sit in the basement and play jazz and stuff. So I grabbed his bass when he wasn't looking, and because I figured it was the most nothing against bass players, but I figured it was the most simple thing to learn quickly, because you didn't have to with a bass, you don't really have to form you know, chords with your fingers and those sorts of things. So I just learned really fast, just because we wanted to put a band together.
Well, four strings is easier than six, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, you know, with bass strings, you can just pound on the string, you know, hitting one note at a time. You know, you don't have to start out like Geddy Lee or anything. You know, you could just start pretty easy. So that's, yeah, I kind of just ran with it.
So you guys were playing over at your house? Like your dad had like a place for you guys to play? Or where
yeah.
were you jamming that early on?
Yeah, we have a, you know, I lived in a townhome in the basement. That's where my dad had kind of his music room. It's kind of like Brian was telling the story about, I forget whose dad it was. It might have been Mike's, but someone's dad was like, "Oh, you got too much free time here. I'm going to teach you Louie Louie." It was kind of like the same thing with us. You know, we were, you know, Ben was always drumming on his desk, so he was clearly going to be a drummer. And then, you know, I grabbed the bass from my dad's, and he had a bass amp in my music room. And so me and Ben just started kind of, you know, even though we had no history with writing songs or music or anything like that. We just started coming up with stuff, and he actually bought, I may be jumping ahead in the narrative here, but you and Brian had talked about Doug Crosby, who was the drummer for Sleestacks, and he was the original drummer for Avail. Well, he recently, right around that time, had gotten bought a new drum kit, and he had this old Tama, or was it Tama? I can't recall, but it was his old kit, and he was trying to unload it, you know, for like a couple $100, just trying to get rid of it real quick. So Ben bought Doug's old drum set, and that's kind of what we started out with. So Ben had Doug Crosby's old drum set. I had my dad's bass, and I guess it was a good thing because me and Ben were best friends, and you know, you always hear about in bands how the bass and the drums kind of have to be in sync. You know, you're the rhythm section, so I guess it was kind of all worked out that we just started him and I just started jamming together, and you know, coming up with stuff.
Yeah, I mean that's a good basis for anybody else to be added to the thing later on after you guys have developed, you know, a certain synchronicity with one another and
right.
chemistry.
Right.
So when did you add other guys? When did Pat come into the group?
Well, we started, you know, just at Ben's house and my house, we just started jamming, coming up with ideas, and Ben and I had more so Ben ahead of me, but we had started getting into you know, punk and hardcore around that time. You know, we started out around that time. It was, you know, at least for us, we started listening to kind of the funny punk songs at first. You know, the lyrics were so hilarious. So we would listen to like Suicidal Tendencies. You know, institutionalized, you know, Mom, I just want a Pepsi, and, you know.
I was in my room, and I was just, like, staring at the wall, thinking about everything. But then again, I was thinking about nothing. And then my mom came in, and I didn't even know she was there. She called my name, and I didn't hear her. And then she started screaming, Mike, Mike! And I go, what? What's the matter? She goes, what's the matter with you? I go, there's nothing wrong, Mom. She goes, don't tell me that. You're on drugs. I go, no, Mom, I'm not on drugs. I'm okay, I'm just thinking, you know. Why don't you give me a Pepsi? She goes, no, you're on drugs. I go, Mom, I'm okay. I'm just thinking. She goes, no, you're not thinking. You're on drugs. Normal people don't act that way. I go, Mom, just give me a Pepsi, please. All I want is a Pepsi. And she wouldn't give it to me. All I wanted was a Pepsi. Just one Pepsi. And she wouldn't give it to me. Just a Pepsi. Keep my spirit with my sleeve. Got me back to see a sleeve. Just yucky. Just lazy. It's a good day. I'm crazy. Oh, I'm not crazy.
We were listening to Circle Jerks and the Meatmen, which was, you know, local, somewhat local to Reston, you know, DC and everything. And so we started getting into that, but then really the first thing that kind of kicked in, you know, high gear for us was right around the same time in late 85, we started getting into Rites of Spring and Dag Nasty, which, you know, now, of course, because of Fugazi, everyone knows about Rites of Spring, but, you know, they were pretty big in the DC scene there and also in the suburbs and everything. And Ben kind of gravitated towards that. You know, anyone who's listened to Rites of Spring, the drums are so, you know, they're crazy. I mean, they're even mic'd crazy.
I was the champion of forgive the debt, but I haven't found a way to forgive you yet. And I know you and I are through. Sometimes a man will blind.
the drums were crazy, so Ben really gravitated towards that. I gravitated towards Dag Nasty pretty big time. They had just, in 86, they had just come out with the Can I Say album, and that totally, you know, changed my life. I was just totally into that. And so that's kind of where we were coming from. So we were like, man, we need to get a, you know, guitar player, singer, you know.
Where did you find that music? Like, where, they weren't playing it on the radio. So where did you discover those bands from?
It's interesting, you know, being in the wrestling scene, you know, I've tried to think of whether it was the proximity to DC or whether it was just, you know, I'm sure that had to play into it because, you know, everyone was getting into DC bands in wrestling. So I don't recall how Ben started getting into Rites of Spring. That might be a, if we ever get a hold of Ben, that might be a Ben story. But I know Dag Nasty for me was Ben had a best friend named Dave Hogan who lived near, I can't remember his name, but he was just a neighborhood friend of Dave Hogan's who somehow knew the guys in Dag Nasty when they had first gotten together. This is when they had Sean Brown singing for him before Dave Smalley got into the band, and they hadn't even, I think they either had just recorded their nine song demo with Sean, which they were actually going to release it as a 1 or 2 6-inches on Discord, but then of course they dropped the whole thing when Dave got into the band, and they re-recorded the album, but they were they had either just recorded it or were just about to record all their demos with Sean. And one day they were pressing shirts. They were silk screening shirts at this friend's house, and so this friend of Dave Hogan, who was a friend of, you know, Ben, who was my best friend, the drummer, he got a hold of one of these shirts, and I think he was just borrowing it, or the friend lent it to him or something. Eventually, he kept it, and it was his. Which I was always mad about that because, you know, Ben wasn't as into Dag Nasty as I was, and I was pretty mad that he got to keep that shirt. But anyway, so that kind of started the whole thing. We saw this shirt, and we were like, oh, that's a band? Yeah, who's in that band? And they were like, well, it's actually the guitar player's Brian Baker that used to play bass and guitar for Minor Threat. And I was like, Minor Threat? Who's Minor Threat? And so, you know, we kind of started digging into everything, and it's, you know, it's the same old story. The guy who got the shirt then had a cassette tape of the Sean Brown demos for Dag Nasty, and we started listening to that. And so, you know, immediately when the Dave Smalley, the Can I Say album came out, you know, we immediately snatched that up because by then we knew who Dag Nasty was. you know how it is. Once you have like one band or, you know, two bands or so in a certain scene, like on a certain label like Discord, you start diving into everything on Discord and everything in that scene. And so that was kind of, you know, our turning point for just getting into everything. And that's kind of really what drove us, you know, to like, man, we need to get a guitar player and a singer, and we need to start, you know, recording music, doing shows, you know, doing everything. It was, we, you know, kind of like Brian was talking about on your podcast, you know, once you kind of get the itch, you know, it's like, you just want to move on it immediately.
And so where'd you find the other guys you were about to tell me before?
Yeah. It was just as simple as we need to find, you know, someone who can sing or scream or whatever, and then we need to find a guitar player. So we got Pat, who we just knew from school. You know, I think I heard you mention in your previous podcast or whatever, you went to Langston Hughes and then to South Lakes. Well, you know, Ben and I were at Langston Hughes when we started hanging out. And so was Pat Kennedy, and so was Jason Radley, who's the guy we eventually got to play guitar. But, you know, we kind of all were in all the same circles with you know, Brian was, I think he was a year older than Ben and I, Ben, Pat, and Jason and I, we were all in the same grade. So Brian was a year ahead of us. And, like, you know, Joe Banks and Doug were, like, 1 to 2 years ahead of us in school. So they were a little bit older than us. But, you know, we started finding out about the whole, you know, emerging music scene. You know, I think Brian mentioned that, you know, Pudwack had been around, which they went on to form Foundation. So we had heard about them. But then the really the first band that we heard about was we had any access to them, and Reston was Stacks. And so we kind of just started knowing everybody there. So we got Pat was, believe it or not, Pat was big into kind of like me, you know, he was more of a mainstream guy. And then all of a sudden, you know, being in that area and with everyone that we went to school with or whatever, he started getting into like Minor Threat. And, you know, he went straight from, you know, David Lee Roth, Eat 'Em and Smile to, you know, Minor Threat. But anyway, we, you know, he was coming up with a bunch of lyrics. I don't know if he was a big, like a poetry guy or if he just wanted to start writing lyrics just to make songs specifically or whatever. But anyway, we got, we, you know, just by knowing him and going to school with him or whatever, he was like, yeah, you know, I've got some lyrics and some stuff. And, you know, I can, you know, he couldn't really sing, but he could scream really, you know, he had a good, I mean, you've heard the demo. He kind of had a, kind of a young Ian MacKay kind of scream, you know, and so he was totally on board for it. But the hard thing was finding a guitar player, because, you know, with punk music, you can or hardcore, you can kind of go one of two ways. You can get some guy who's just a noisy guitar player who, you know, maybe he's not the greatest guitar player, but, you know, he can do the power chords and, you know, is noisy or whatever. Or you can try and find someone like, you know, like a Brian Baker or a Dr. No or somebody who, you know, they may be, you know, noisy, but you can tell they've got like musical training, you know, they can do guitar solos and stuff like that. So we just wanted anybody that we just wanted to start a band. So we were like, anybody that can play guitar, we'll grab them. And we met, Jason Radley in school, and he was big into like classic rock. You know, he could do the guitar solos. He was all, you know, the Hendrix stuff, Led Zeppelin, you know, he was more classic, but he had this big desire to just be in a band also. He just wanted to play music. So, he was like, well, you know, I don't really know too much about punk, but, you know, I'll sign up and we'll just, you know, we'll just see what the four of us can do.
And so, what was like your first show? How did that transition into like actually playing in front of people?
Well, you know, we needed a place.
Even
to,
before
to
that, what was the first song where it all clicked?
Actually, you know, that's kind of a funny story, but you know how a lot of punk bands, one of the signature things they do is they always seem to write like a song that has the name of the band as the name of the song. So, you know, you've got your marginal man, you know, you've got, Minor Threat, Roots was the Minor Threat. You know, everyone, they all seemed to write that song that is the name of the band. So that was our first song. I was like, well, I forget who brought up the name.
Did you have the name of the band first, or you wrote the song and then you were like, we should name the band that because that's our signature song?
You know, I'm a little fuzzy on which one came first, but I want to say that Pat had the idea for the name, and also the lyric. You know, at kind of around the same time, and we just thought the name was cool. You know, because you could shorten it. You could do the initials HE, and that was good to write everywhere and put on flyers. I think it just came at the same time, so we wrote that song, Hostile Environment, and it just, even though it wasn't like, it didn't have the really fast, hardcore beat, but it was kind of more of a Sex Pistols kind of, rhythm to it. It just kind of really set it off, and we were all like, man, that sounds really, it was really simple, very, very simple, even by punk standards, but we just thought it sounded so cool. Started writing songs from there. We were practicing in the basement of there was this girl we went to high school with named Betsy Nord, and she was like a year older than us, and she actually was dating Joe Banks, who at that time had not started Avail yet, because we're talking about 1986 right now. So he had obviously played guitar in Sleestax, and then they had recently broken up, or no, they were still together right at this time. But anyway, he was dating this girl named Betsy Nord, and so we stashed all of our gear in her basement, and we practiced there, and we just would go there every day after school, play music. And then once we had like 3, 4, 5 songs together, Joe Banks was like, man, I'd like to record this stuff. This is really cool, because he was kind of just hanging out with Betsy at the time. So he brought over his he had a 4-track Radio Shack realistic mixer, and he would try, and we only had a couple mics, so he would try and kind of mic everything the best he could, and it would go into those 4 tracks. So it was like one mic would be in front of the entire drum kit, and then one mic would be in front of the guitar amp, one mic in front of the bass amp, and then Pat held the fourth mic. All those went into the realistic mixer, and then he would just plug that into a boombox, and put on headphones, and just he'd tell us to play for 2 or 3 minutes, and he'd kind of keep mixing while we were playing till it sounded like it was mixed, somewhat okay, and then he was like, all right, start playing every song and we'll record the demos.
Punk rock, man.
Yeah, seriously.
So, about the name, just one more thing. Did you consider like Reston to be a hostile environment towards kids, towards teens, towards musicians?
In some respects, yeah. I mean, we didn't, we didn't have a lot, you know, I don't know if you've seen the Salad Days documentary about DC. There was definitely tensions between, you know, like any high school, you have the jocks and you have the gangs and, the metalheads. And then we didn't really have a skinhead, problem in South Lakes, but then you had the punks and everything. So while people would get into your normal, high school fights and stuff, it wasn't a very violent, school scene or anything like that. Everyone was in Reston, if you're on a bike path late at night, you never know if you're going to get jumped by somebody or whatever, for whatever reason. But that was kind of just normal stuff, probably the only thing, and maybe this probably had something to do with it, but the only kind of real hostility we were receiving at the time was more because we all, except for Jason wasn't a skateboarder, but we all skated. And, around that time, it was like, everybody, all the storefronts up at, up by Kemp Mill Records or whatever, you technically couldn't skate like anywhere, everyone was kicking the skateboarders out, no loitering, and, the Reston Homeowners Association, ROA, would, if somebody put like a little street ramp to skate on and, in their cul-de-sac or whatever, they would come down and crack on that. So, but that was probably our biggest, quote unquote hostile environment was people just so against skateboarding. And then, by extension, not just skateboarding, but, it was mainly punks and, stuff that were skating and everything. So it was, we did receive a lot of, I guess it, less violence, but more like, looks and people just against that whole kind of lifestyle and aesthetic, the skating, the punk rock, everything like that.
Yeah, it's funny how that shifted in like society and how mainstream skating has become.
It cracks me up because I've got, just like Brian, I've got I don't know how many kids Brian has, but I've got a couple kids. And you go to the mall and it's like, half the teens you run into are wearing Vans. And like, I don't know if it's the same where you are now, but in the last like year or two, like 75% of the kids I see walking around have also magazine t-shirts. I mean, it's insane. It's a cool thing. It was cool even back in the 80s and early 90s, but it's like a mainstream cool now, and a lot of towns have the skate parks you can go to and everything. Of course, back in those days in California, you had skate parks everywhere, but in the rest of the country, that was kind of you didn't see a lot of that. And so, even here in Texas, my kid goes out and skates, they have a public skate park with, pools and everything. It's just, it's crazy how mainstream it is.
Yeah, we would have killed for that shit in Reston, too.
Oh, we used to have, I keep referencing the podcast with Brian, so I hope there's not a lot of people listening to this going, what is he talking about when he keeps saying Brian? But anyway, if anybody has listened to it, they need to listen to your podcast from a week or two ago. But, he was talking about the whole, when him and Brian McCracken would make the stage with the milk crates and the plywood. And that got me thinking about how there were so many construction sites around Reston, building townhomes and apartment complexes and houses and stuff. And I'd like to say that I was as good of a punk as Brian was, where he was talking about the milk crates but then returning them. But we, unfortunately, we didn't have the option of buying taking plywood and making, skateboard ramps and then, disassembling the ramps and returning them. So
it was pretty expensive to get it from Heckinger's,
Yeah. we just basically straight up stole plywood, and we would literally go, you would take a bike path to some area in the woods that was just in the middle where like nobody could access it unless they knew where they were going. And then we would build, like half pipes in the middle of the woods, and they'd be these secret locations or whatever. And you could even spray paint on them, you know, ROA, Reston Homeowners Association, ROA sucks, you know, and that kind of thing. And so it was very, you know, we would set up ramps just pretty much everywhere we could, you know, secret little ramps in the middle of the woods somewhere.
So, getting back to your shows, like when you actually started playing for people as Hostile Environment, what was the reaction and how did it make you feel?
Yeah, we were, you know, Joe was recording those demos for us, but it wasn't, you know, a lot of bands are like, you know, they want to record so they can put stuff out. And at that time, since there weren't a lot of bands, you know, putting out, you know, they weren't doing seven inches or tapes or anything, you know, at least in the Reston area, at least not yet. So those demos were kind of just for like us and people we went to school with, and, you know, you'd pass them on tapes and stuff. So that was like the whole demo thing. And then we were at a certain point when we had, you know, enough songs, we were like, man, you know, it'd be really cool to like play a show or whatever. And, you know, of course, what we were thinking of is, you know, we're not thinking like, you know, hey, you know, let's get big enough to where we can go into DC and play at, you know, the Black Cat or 930 Club or whatever. You know, obviously that was like some kind of way off goal that we could have never even dreamed of. But we were like, we just want to play, and it's like, okay, locally, what can we do? And so we were like, you know, that's when, you know, Brian and Brian McCracken and Brian Stewart and everybody, they started coming up with these ideas of doing the shows in the garages, and you know, someone's parents were out of town. It was kind of like the whole, you know, 16 Candles, you know, movie where you have like 200 kids at a house or whatever, but at least in our version, it was, you know, it was there to go there and to see the music and everything. So we started,
we did that in my house, you know. My house was one of those houses later on, like 10 years later, you know.
Oh, wow.
My house was that house.
I hope it survived.
Yeah, sure. It's amazing how little stuff got broken or stolen. There's a funny story from my friend, this kid Tim Waite, where he threw one of those parties at his house, and people were walking out of his house with like couches and furniture.
Oh.
Like, they're
that's
just
terrible.
Taking it out of his house, and he had to call 911 on his own party.
Oh, my gosh. That is crazy. Well, luckily, we didn't have a lot of that going on. I know there was one show, and I think this is the show that I sent you either the link or the files to or whatever, and it was at Stan Havistus's house, which I think Brian mentioned him in your previous podcast, but he... I don't know if his parents were out of town or whether it was just an afternoon where, you know, I don't know what the circumstances were, but yeah, we had a lot of people at that one, and, you know, some holes got kicked in the wall and stuff, you know, and I always felt really bad about that because I know I wouldn't want that happening to my house. So I was always trying to be pretty respectful of everyone's house, but it was amazing, you know, where you'd get, It was getting, you know, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. We didn't have enough songs. We had, at that time, we had like maybe 6-7 songs. So we're like, okay, we need to find somebody to play.
You're like, that'll last about 10 minutes.
Exactly. So, you know, we got to find, you know, more people on the bill here. And that's when we just through people we knew at school, we found out about LDK, Learning Disabled Kids. And I really don't recall whether they started a little bit before us or maybe a little bit after us, but at the time we were starting, it was like Sleafax was just ending, and really us and LDK were the only, at that moment in time in 86, we were the only, the only two games in town really. And so every party or show or whatever, it was always, you know, LDK and Hostile Environment. And it was, you know, it got to be kind of funny because, you know, you'd go to a show or a party or whatever, and every time it would be the same two bands. It's like, hey, it's LDK and Hostile Environment again, you know. But it was like Brian was talking about, you know, we had we had the PA system that everyone kind of passed around. And then, you know, we would set up like LDK's drum set. And I think Brian mentioned that Tim Berry was the drummer for LDK at that point, who, you know, he later went on to go sing for Avail after Brian. But we would, you know, his drum set would be set up. And then Mike Munoz, the guitar player for LDK, our guitar player would use his amp. He would just plug his, you know, guitar into it. And then I would use so it was kind of like, you know, the setup was there for both bands, but we would both use the same,
like a back line.
Exactly. And Tim Berry had this weird, I don't know if you know what a China cymbal is, but,
yeah.
Tim Berry had,
yeah.
It's one of those upside down cymbals that when you hit it, it almost sounds like a
gong.
A light version of a gong kind of.
Yeah.
But I don't know what the deal was, you know.
That is not very punk rock.
It was not punk. And even Ben and his drum set, just because at the beginning he was piecing together a drum set from Doug's old set and some other things. But Ben actually had some roto toms in his set instead of regular toms. So it kind of sounded like if you ever listen to the Meat Men album, War of the Superbikes, when that guy does a drum roll, you hear all these like go-go toms. And, you know, Ben had some go-go toms and then that China cymbal. If you listen to that live show at Fans, you'll hear every once in a while Ben will hit the China cymbal. And it's so out of place because, you know, you're playing the song that sounds like, you know, Minor Threat. And then all of a sudden you read, you know, like it's, you know, freaking Alex Van Halen back there or something. It's hilarious.
Well, I guess if you got it, you might as well use it.
Yeah, we used it, but yeah, we just used the same setup.
Good thing you didn't have wind chimes.
You know, I'm surprised we never did wind chimes or whatever. But yeah, we kind of were just, it was for like close to a year. It was just LDK and Hostile Environment, and every show was just us two. And then, but then all of a sudden in early 87, that's when everything seemed to kick in. And I think what had happened is a lot of people we went to school with had been going to these shows and saw that, you know, not to sound crazy, but, you know, they were like, man, this doesn't look that hard. You know, LDK, they were much better musicians than we were. And they had way more intricate You know, later on they did some demos at Inner Ear that just, you know, you listen to and you're like, wow, you know, this is really good stuff. But, it, you know, at the time it was all kind of rudimentary and just like, you know, most good punk rock is. And I think a lot of people in Reston, a lot of kids we went to school with were like, man, you know, if they're doing this, we can do this. So that's when all of a sudden things just, other bands just started popping up everywhere. Not because, like, you know, like we were some kind of godfathers of the scene or whatever. It's they, I think just people, after a certain amount of shows, going to see both LDK and Austin Violent, they eventually were like, man, you know, if we kind of come up with our own thing and come up with some songs or whatever, you know, maybe we can start playing some of these shows and stuff. And that's kind of what happened. You know, you had Knothead with Dave and Carter Blitz, who's now drumming in JFA. He's been drumming for JFA for years, but you know, they started playing shows, and there was this one band called Transilience that popped up, where they were more of like, they were kind of like the Rush of the scene. They were playing like some really intricate, like prog classic kind of rock. And there was Terracator and Friends and this band called Crunchy Water, which they were straight up like classic rock. You know, they had the long hair in it. But I mean, everyone kind of, even though it wasn't all, you know, exactly punk, everyone, you know, got along great. And everyone was just like, you know, we didn't care how many bands or what kind of music it was or whatever. It was just, everyone just wanted to, you know, just play.
Yeah, well, that's what I think is awesome about the scene. And that's the thing about this show, too, is it's not just it's not for just punk rock or Reston hardcore, you know? This is about the diversity of music that actually came out of Reston. And, you know, and the fact that it was a scene that was welcoming to a lot of different kinds of stuff. I mean, I don't know about you, you know, I like punk and I like hardcore, but I also listen to a lot of other stuff too. You know, I listen to hip hop, I listen to jazz, I listen to funk, I listen to classic rock. I like DC Go-Go. I like, you know, a lot of different kinds of music. So, and the thing is, I like all of those bands. I like, you know, Crunchy Water used to rehearse in Cater's household, which was up the street from, my best friend on Wake Robin Lane. So we'd be playing street hockey out there, and they would be going at it in the basement, and that's how I knew Crunchy Water,
right?
You know,
yeah.
I was friends with Jake Cater, and so you know, Aaron and Gabe and those guys were his older brothers. So it's like, his older brothers like jamming at, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it was, that's one of the great things about the music scene is, you know, everyone definitely had their own, taste, but, you know, everyone was very tolerant of whatever music they wanted to play. You know, I mean, you know, you might make fun of it sometimes. Like a lot of times we would make fun of, you know, Jason, our guitar player, you know, we'd make fun of it because he'd want to stick a guitar solo in or whatever. And we're like, oh, you know, you're just, you know, you're into that classic rock and everything, you know. You know, we're doing punk, though, you know. So, I mean, you make fun of people and everything, but everyone was very tolerant of what everything, you know, everything that was going on at the time. You know, we even had, it was
the
funny.
Classic rock is awesome. Hendrix
is awesome.
Led Zeppelin is awesome. The Rolling Stones.
Yeah, I listened to some of our old demos. I don't know if you listened to the whole demo, Hustle Environment demo I sent you, but near the end of it was one of the very first songs we ever did. And it was, I think it was called Cops Suck, which, you know, great hardcore title there. But it even had this crazy classic rock guitar solo in the middle. At the time, we were like, this is awesome, you know, but, you know, of course, now you listen to it, and it's so out of place, but, I mean, it was great, you know, the guys in LDK, like Tim Berry, it's so funny, you know, just later on when he sang for Avail, And, you know, you're looking at the, you know, the albums that the Avail albums that came out later on Lookout and then Fat Rack and everything, you know, Tim Berry's this, you know, there's the whole, you know, after Avail moved to Richmond, they had, you know, this whole kind of aesthetic, this Richmond aesthetic, you know, like the hats and the, you know, I mean, I don't think they were trying to go for this aesthetic, but it just, it is what it was, what it was. And they, when Tim was in LDK and he was the drummer for LDK, he was like, at the time, he was a super metalhead. Like he hung out, you know, the bass player for LDK was this guy named Tim Mosky. And then Tim Berry was the drummer and they were both
Chris
like
Mosky.
Super metal. Chris Mosky, yeah, not, yeah. His brother was, I think his brother was Tom Mosky. So, Chris Mosky, and they were both like super metalheads. You know, they had the metalhead hair. They wore the, you know, the jean jackets with the, or it was the leather jacket with the jean jacket over it, but with the arms cut off kind of a thing, you know, and then on the back, you know, sewn onto the back was like, you know, Metallica, Kill 'Em All and stuff like that. So even though they were part of the hardcore, you know, punk scene playing in LDK, both Chris and Tim were huge, you know, like DRI, Sepultura, you know, early Metallica, you know, they were big into like metal. And it was hilarious because you'd have all these kids at the parties, like, you know, Pat, our singer, when we started Hostile Environment, he was a big straight edge guy, you know. Minor Threat was his thing. Ian MacKay was his guy. He was like, you know, he smoked, but he was like, I'm not drinking. I'm not doing drugs. I'm not doing any of this. I'm straight edge, you know, X on the hand and everything. But then, you know, sitting right next to him, you'd have, you know, Chris and Tim, and they, you know, they plow through like a case of Bush beer themselves before LDK even went on to play, you know. And I was always amazed. For some reason, it was always Bush beer, but they would literally every show we played with LDK, it was Tim and Chris that just had all this stash of Bush beer, and they would just plow through it. You know, it was amazing. Okay. But yeah, that was the thing. You know, the straight edge and the kids that partied and everything. Everybody at that time in the music scene, you know, 86, 87, 88, even 89, everyone just got along, and it was all just like everyone just wanted to play shows and hang out. And you know, some of the guys were drinking and doing drugs, and some of the other guys were like, no, I'm straight edge. It was fine. It was like, whatever. You know, we all just still hung out.
Well, how do you remember the Jams for Man, like, invite coming to you guys and that whole thing coming together?
I have kind of a unique history with Jams for Man. The very first Jams for Man that they were putting together for, I believe, 88. It was in, I think, June. I want to say June of 88. But I know it was definitely in 88. I actually, believe it or not, I moved away from Reston right before the first jam from in. And I was so heartbroken because, you know, we were always playing, you know, parties and garage shows and everything. And I always, you know, as we kept on going as a band and everything, I started getting that taste. Like Dag Nasty's Wig Out of Denko's came out in 87. And then I was, you know, we were listening to, just all the stuff coming out on Discord. And by that time, non-Discord bands were getting big in the area, like Kingface and, Swizz was on, Samet's, you know, and just the whole area was kind of, at least in that area, it was just blowing up. And so I started thinking, you know, man, maybe we could put out, you know, we've got better at what we were doing. And I was like, maybe we could put out a record. Maybe we could play real shows. So when they were, you know, when we heard about the whole Jam for Man getting organized and everything, you know, I was excited about it, but it turned out unfortunately I was, that summer I was finishing up 10th grade and, my dad got transferred. And so I was heartbroken. I moved, it was probably April or May of 88, right before the first Jam for Man. And so Pat Kennedy, because he was still obviously singing for Minor Threat. It was Bo Butler, you know, for Avail, Bobo.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
He played, he played bass for Hostile Environment at the first jam for Man because I had just moved. So he had to learn all the songs, and he played bass. So I don't know if there's video or audio or whatever, but that first Jam for Man show in the early summer '88, it was Bo Butler who played bass for Hostile Environment because I had just moved, and like right before I moved, just a few weeks before I moved, that's when we got together in Brian Stewart's basement and Joe Banks. By that time, I think he had like an 8-track realistic mixer. You know, he had graduated from 4 to 8, and Hostile Environment got together and we recorded pretty much every song we knew, which was the demo that I sent you. The bulk of the first 75% of that was from that in '88, right before I moved. So, you know, it really sucked because I couldn't do Jam for Man. Bo played bass, and then I came. You know, I kept coming back to visit Reston. I would stay with Jason Radley, or I would stay with Ben or some other people. I would come back during the summer sometimes, and then during Christmas time or whatever. And I would come and I'd hang out and play, you know, play shows and stuff like that. But yeah, I came back after Jam for Man had happened, and you know, Pat was telling me all the stories about it, and he was showing me the Jam for Man T-shirt and everything, and I was so depressed that I could not be part of that. So my history with Jam for Man is a big history of regret that I could, you know, I was there in spirit, you know, the people I knew were in it, and Hostile Environment, you know, my band was in it, but unfortunately I was not able to take part of it.
Well, so with those recordings, what did you guys wind up doing with them? Did you make covers? Did you make, like, how many copies of them did you make?
We did. Like, we
what,
made a
what,
lot.
What did you do? Did you sell them on consignment anywhere?
I don't think we ever sold them. I think we gave them away to as many people as we could. We Pat definitely drew covers. There's one cover, I think Brian has some of it, but it's like, you know, Pat came up with this idea of like a hand with fingers crossed, and then on the top of the hand was HE, you know, for Hostile Environment. So, you know, we had covers and lyric sheets and tapes, you know, kind of like a lot of the tapes that would float around then, like Knotheads tape and Slee Stacks and Avail and everything. And so, you know, we definitely had tons of tapes, gave them around to people and everything. I think we just gave them away for free, you know. And we did a lot of other shows, you know, other than the house party shows. Like we opened up for Slee Stacks a few times. We played at Gonzaga High School in downtown D.C., which that was a crazy show. You know, Gonzaga, it was, I don't know if it was a private school or it was like a Catholic
school.
Yeah, it was like, you know, people in uniforms and everything. And all of a sudden, you know, we roll in with Slee Stacks, and it was like, it was a crazy show, you know, but it was fun. I think I still have the flyer for that. I might have to send you the.
If you listen to one of my other podcasts, there's an episode with a guy named John T. Hastings, who was in a band called Utris, and all those guys actually went to Gonzaga High School. In the early to mid '90s. And Junkyard played their prom.
That's awesome.
So apparently there's a pretty good history of Virginia and DC bands playing at Gonzaga High School. They get the cream of the crop over there.
Yeah, I don't even know how. You know, one day it was like Slee Stacks were going to go play there, and they were like, "Hey, do you want to come open for us?" They asked us a couple of days ahead of time, and we were like, sure, when is it? And they said, well, it's actually in the afternoon. And I'm like, well, that's during school. And they were like, yeah, we're all going to skip school. I'm like, okay. And so we met in the front of the school, and I think even one of the people out, you know, in the parking lot stopped us on our way out, and they were like, where are you guys going? And we're just going to go, I don't even know what we said. But, yeah, we went in a big van with Slee Stacks to Gonzaga, and it was like an afternoon, you know, 2 or 3 o'clock show. It was just weird, but yeah, it was great. So yeah, we definitely had, you know, tapes and stuff like that, but we never got to the point to where we were selling anything. You know, it was just to pass around to friends and people and, you know, stuff like that. I think I sent one copy into to Discord, because I'm like, you know how that's going to go. I'm going to send that in. They're going to say, this is just awesome, and then we're going to put out an album on Discord. But, yeah, I'm sure you can guess how that went, you know.
So there was an effort then on your behalf to try to make it bigger, to try to, you know, get signed, or at least signed by your favorite label.
Yeah, it was probably me and only me. You know, the rest of them were, you know, we were all enjoying ourselves and, you know, having fun playing the parties and stuff. I'm the kind of the one who was like, you know, I'd like this to be a thing. You know, I wasn't thinking like career or anything, but I was like, you know, I'd love to actually record something. And I would bring it up to the other guys, and they were kind of just like, you know, yeah, that'd be cool, whatever. But, you know, nothing ever really came of it. So I tried, we used to go to, in Georgetown, we used to go to Smash a lot, Smash Records. Ben and I and some friends would, you know, we'd skip school for the day and we'd skate. Literally skate DC, you know, you'd skate all through downtown, go to the Underground Mall, you know, skate on the Lincoln Memorial, that kind of thing. And we'd go to Smash and, you know, hang out in Georgetown and everything. But one day when I was up there, I ran into, Sean Brown at Smash. And, you know, I started bringing up our band and, you know, the whole wrestling thing or whatever. And he, I don't know if he was just playing along, like he had heard of some wrestling bands or whatever, or if he'd actually heard of them, but he was kind of like, yeah, you know, I've heard about something about wrestling. And, you know, he mentioned a couple things or whatever. And so I got his number, and I was going to, you know, give him a call and try and send him one of our demos to see if, you know, if we could get some kind of, like, third slot, you know, opening for Swizz, who would probably be opening for somebody else or whatever. And I called him, and I think I sent the demo tape to Sean. But I never heard anything from that point. And I kept telling, you know, I'd tell Ben, because we'd always hang out. I'd be like, you know, maybe Sean's going to call back and maybe we're going to get on Discord. You know, I'm a 15, 16-year-old kid, and I'm, you know, I'm thinking, like, this is going to lead to something. This is some big, big stuff. But, it, you know, nothing ever came of it. So, yeah, I was definitely wanting to push more and do more. But you know, it kind of stayed just more of a local thing. I always tend to think that if I would have stayed in the area and kept on, you know, either with Hostile Environment or something else, that I would have been involved with something that would have been put something out in a you know, kind of a professional capacity there in DC. Because I moved to Texas in '88, and I went on to do things in Texas. You know, I was in bands and put out CDs and stuff like that. So, you know, I did keep on that.
Well, what are the bands? What are the bands and what were the CDs? Tell us.
There was a band called Split Decision, which they're, you know, just like any good band name. There was a Split Decision in DC. There was probably a Split Decision in every town in America. But I was in a band called Split Decision, and then
apparently there was a wrestling one named Split Decision that was a go-go band. There were the guys from Crunchy Water wound up forming another go-go band called Split Decision.
That's awesome. Yeah, that, I mean, Split Decision is just one of those names. It's like Last Wish or, you know, whatever. There's 10 million bands. You know, Battery. You know, there's 10,000 bands that, you know, love Metallica that named their band, you know, Battery. So, we put out some stuff as Picnic Boy, but it was all, you know, it was all independent. We're actually in West Texas, kind of in the Lubbock, not that this means anything to you, but the Lubbock Midland area. We did some radio shows and stuff, because that was back, you know, early 90s, like 90, 91, when, you know, Nirvana was just, and Pearl Jam were just starting to, you know, hit big. So there was that big scramble to find, you know, anything that was alternative-ish, you know, even if they didn't sound exactly like, you know, I mean, you recall there were bands getting signed like Shudder to Think and Jawbot, you know, that were, you know, moving from Discord up to major labels, and Sam I Am, and, you know, even Bad Religion went from Epitaph to Atlantic, and that was just a crazy time. So, like, all these, you know, bands that were maybe punk but had like an alternative flavor to them, they were getting interest. And so, you know, I was in some bands that got some interest, definitely did, you know, demos and CDs and stuff. You know,
what was your big hit song?
we had some, when I was in Split Decision, and then we changed our name to Picnic Boy, which I still have no idea where that came from, but we did two CDs. The first CD was like a 6-song EP, and the second CD was like it was about the same, 5 or 6 songs. And it's funny, the shift, because the first one, I was kind of still in kind of punk mode. I was really big into, you know, starting out with Dag Nasty and then moving on to like Descendants and All and those sorts of things. So it's like you hear the music stayed pretty good, you know, very fast paced, you know, hardcore type stuff. But the lyrics started shifting from, you know, ranting about society to, you know, talking about, does the girl down the street like me, kind of a thing, you know. Kind of stuff or whatever, so you'll I think you'll get a good, there's even some stuff in there that is even a little bit metal-ish, you know, in 87 88, when Guns N' Roses, you know, everything was kind of influencing everything. You had a lot of bands that were like punk, but then they were like metal, and then they were like alternative, like Mindfunk, you know. I don't know if you ever listened to Mindfunk, with it had the singer from it was Pat what's his name, from Uniform Choice. And he did this band called Mindfunk with the ex-guitar player from Nirvana, and they did, like, funky metal. It was crazy. It was before he did, like, some of his Insane Clown Posse stuff or whatever. I mean, that guy really went off the rails. But it's just funny how a lot of bands, like, even Uniform Choice, you know, you listen to that first Screaming for Change album, and it's very Minor Threat-ish, and it's like, wow, this is really awesome. And then their next album, Staring Into the Sun, for Giant Records, was like metal. It was a little hardcore-ish, but it was metal, you know, and they all had long hair and stuff. So it was really interesting, all the bands that kind of shifted, like even Dag Nasty.
So Picnic Boy shifted then, huh?
Yeah, definitely. There's at the end of our second EP, you'll definitely hear a couple metal-ish songs, you know, that I'm not exactly proud of, but they're fun to listen to.
Hey man, there's a lot of music in my back catalog that I don't necessarily stand by, but you know, it's still,
yeah,
it's out there, and you know, you you develop as an artist over time, you know,
and
sometimes
kinda...
you have to go down some blind alleys to find the good stuff.
And a lot of bands that were out for years and stuff, they all went through shifts. Like 7 Seconds, you know, you listen to some of the later albums, like Second Wind and everything, they sound like U2, you know, and that, or you have like, you know, DYS with Dave Smalley, you know, the before the KSA album, when he was in DYS, he did a Wolfpack, and that's a great album. And then you listen to the DYS's second album, and it's all metal too. And, you know, everyone went through shifts, even Circle Jerks and, you know, even Adolescence to a certain degree, they kind of went metal-ish, you know, in their later days and stuff. So it is all these bands that were around for a number of years, they all seem to go through their, you know, their fads, kind of a thing.
Well, so
Did you keep in touch with the guys from Hostile Environment after you moved to Texas? And do you know what became of those guys and what musically?
Yeah, I did for a while. You know, Ben still plays the drums, but he and I just reconnected recently. But I did stay in touch with him into the 90s and stuff. But he moved to Atlanta where his dad lived, and he still drummed and everything, but he kind of, you know, he went into banking and insurance and stuff, and now he owns his own painting and construction company. Pat did like the construction on movie sets, and now he owns his own construction company in Virginia. And the funniest one is Jason. So Jason Radley, you know, he was our guitar player, and you know, he was a big classic rock guy, you know, indulged a little in some of the herbal extremities and everything. And he is funny, you know. I always was curious what he was going to wind up doing, and we just recently reconnected, and he's actually went to Harvard and graduated with like a doctorate in neuroscience, and he actually heads the neuroscience division at University of Ohio. It's like the Jason Radley Neurosciences division. And
nice.
You know, he's the head of the department, and he's like, he publishes all these papers and stuff about neuroscience and everything, and the study of the brain and everything. It's just insane. You know, that could be a good idea for like a documentary sometime about, you know, what all these old, you know, punk rock guys eventually did with their lives. And it's surprising to, you know, like Brian Stewart, you know, he became a teacher, and, you know, I never thought he'd be married with kids and everything. A funny story about Brian, I have to tell you this, because, you know, Brian and I've reconnected over the years, and, you know, I mean, you've talked to him with the podcast and everything. He's a great guy, and very, you know, just music's been his life and everything. But the funny story I have on Brian Stewart is the very first time I met him, it was like 86, and I was hanging out with Ben in front of Highs. You know, every good story in Houston starts with Highs. And we're in front of Highs, and Brian comes up, and he's hanging with some other guys. I don't know who it was. And, you know, we're all talking about music and this and that and everything. And then I'm about to leave, and I'm pretty sure it was a piece of gum. I had just put a piece of gum in my mouth, and I took the wrapper. And, you know, I'm a 15-year-old kid, you know. I could have cared less about the environment at the time, you know, unfortunately. And I think you
were hostile to the environment.
Yeah, I was. I was very hostile to the environment. But I threw the wrapper from the piece of gum on the ground. You know, I just chucked it. Didn't throw it in the trash can. I just threw it on the ground. And Brian Stewart actually turned around, and he spit in my face. He was like, he was just so incensed that I had just littered. And that was the funny thing about Brian is he was punk through and through, but he also had this huge like moral streak, you know, which is why I was, you know, when you hear stories about him stealing all those milk crates, building the stage, and then returning them, you know, that was Brian. It was like, you know, he did whatever he needed to do to get the job done, but he was moral about it, you know. Yeah, my big idea, and we're probably running out of time here, but my big idea, and I floated this to Brian about a year ago, and it even didn't gain traction, or maybe just there wasn't, you know, the people couldn't participate or whatever. But my big idea was, you know, 88 to 2018, you know, 30th anniversary of the first Jam for Man. My idea was is we should see how many of the old Reston guys we could get back to Reston and do a Jam for Man, and like the bands could all play together again, or maybe, you know, there could be a core band and people sit in with them and they do a bunch of songs from the old days or whatever. So that was my big idea. It didn't seem to work out or whatever, but I actually sent Brian a text a few days ago.
We still got time. 2018's only halfway through.
You know, we could do a 31st anniversary, because, you know, I mean, you know, Guns N' Roses just came out with their, you know, their Appetite for Destruction, you know, four CD remaster, you know, demo thing or whatever. And it's 31 years after it came out. So, I mean, you can do 31. So, yeah, that's
when
that's my
whenever
big idea.
The Reston Community Center is available, that's when we'll be able to put it on.
Or we could just do it somewhere, you know, we could just do it somewhere else. But, yeah, I actually texted Brian a couple of days ago. I told him I was going to give him a call. I still haven't called him. I was going to call him this weekend to let him get, you kind of float my idea that, you know, we should do something like that. I mean, that would be awesome.
That is a great, great idea. And
someone could actually
video
it with, like, quality. You know, these days it doesn't take much more to be quality, more quality than it was in the 80s. You could do it with an iPhone and it would still look spectacular. But you could video it or, you know, whatever. Or just,
definitely.
Yeah.
Make the posters.
Sell the
old tape.
Yep. Get the Knothead guys together. The Transilience, Crunchy Water, Hostile Environment. You know, it sounds, Ryan said, it sounds like LDK. You know, that's kind of iffy. You know, of course, Andy's not with us anymore. But, you know, even, you know, just whoever, you know, that'd be awesome.
If nothing else, you know, I'm trying to do my part, and I hope to interview pretty much everybody that played in the original Jam for Man concert. And
right.
I will float the idea now to every single person and find out whether they're interested.
There you go. I'm serious. You know, unfortunately. I'm like the guy, you know, I don't know if you've ever heard of this guy. His name is Jason.
You just want to finally be able to play a Jam for Man. I think that's what this whole thing is about.
I do. I am the Jason Everman of Rest and Hardcore. You know, he's this guy. I read an article in Rolling Stone about him. Great, interesting read. But he was the second guitarist in Nirvana. And right before, I believe he's on Bleach. He played on Bleach. And right before they did the tour, right before they recorded Nevermind and everything, they dumped him. And so he misses out on Nevermind, you know, which that's huge in and of itself. So then he joins Soundgarden, and he's their third guitarist. And then they dump him right before they got onto A&M Records and recorded, it was either Ultra Mega, okay, or no, that was what that's. But it was right before Soundgarden broke big with, you know, Outshined and, you know, their big album on A&M Records. And so this guy, it was interesting. This article was all about, like, all the near misses of, like, classic bands that he had been in and then, you know, left right before they hit it big. So that's kind of like me, you know. It was like, you know, I almost made it to the Jam for Man, and then, you know, I was gone right before it happened, so...
All right, well, we're going to have to make it happen so that you can play a Jam for Man. Finally, Matt. Finally, after all this time. Well, listen, I really appreciate you coming on. I thank you so much for your time and all these stories and everything. It's been really great. You, your knowledge of music is impeccable. And I'm going to have to go back, and when I listen through all of this, make a list of all of these albums that you've referenced. Go check out virtually all of them.
You know,
I hope other people are going to deep dive and do the same thing.
You know, I've got a lot of crazy stories about. Maybe we could do a part two sometime of us all just jumping into a car and driving down to the 9:30 show, going to see. You know, we saw a show with Dag Nasty, and the opening bands were Swizz and Kingface. I mean, that's a killer show, and I had a tape recorder down my pants, and I recorded the whole show. So I got that. I can see those files. You know, I've got a lot of good stories about those days. I can kind of go on and on and on and on about
it. Well, you've told us plenty for this one episode, and we definitely should do another one. I would love to have you back. And
all right, sounds good.
I just really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. And
to share
your love of Northern Virginia DC music with us.
Yeah,
it's just great.
I really appreciate it. I love the whole idea of the podcast you're doing, and you know, those were good times. So anytime I get to talk about them is a good time.
Well, keep listening, man. You're going to be surprised by some of the people that you hear from and some of these bands. And then ones that you've never heard of before can be pleasant surprises, too. So I hope you'll keep listening as coming back.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely.
All right, man, great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
All right,
thanks.
Talk
again soon. All right. Bye.
Thank you.